I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Ken Selzer has been the insurance commissioner of Kansas for 3 years. Now he's got his sights set on a higher office, the governorship. With a crowded field of candidates, it's sure to be a contentious campaign season. Today we'll ask the fourth-generation Kansan why he's the one to make state government more efficient and what he'll do to kickstart the economy. Then the cinephiles take us back in time to 1968. It was a remarkable year in film, not just because of the movies that were released, but because of the creative tone and direction they took. We'll find out how film has changed in the 50 years since. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Republican Ken Selzer is running for Kansas governor, promising to take a more business-like approach to state government. He says that's what he's done to the insurance department that he oversees as the state's insurance commissioner. He advocates more tax cuts and a constitutional amendment that he says would end the ceaseless rounds of litigation over the funding of public schools. Our conversation with Ken Selzer is part of our ongoing interviews with Kansas gubernatorial candidates. Ken, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here. Really great to be here.
You're running for governor in one of the largest fields in state history. How are you going to break through in a Republican primary field that includes two much better known candidates, Jeff Collier, the current governor, Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State? And I bet you've been asked this question more than once.
It's really straightforward and easy. I'm a CPA. I've had a business career. 4 years ago, Kansans elected me to be their insurance commissioner in a statewide race. We won in a crowded primary. We won big, big in the general election. We appealed to a cross-section of people like almost no other. We did a good job there, and we're approaching it the same way in this election. We're talking about running the state more like a business, bringing basic business practices to the state, just like we did in the insurance department.
But what makes you such a better candidate than your two main rivals here, again, Chris Kobach and Jeff Collier?
I've got a track record of success in business. I've got a track record of success, big success, in government. Nobody else can say that. I'm the only one there with a business background, the only one with a CPA, which seems to be particularly relevant right now, and the only one with those two qualifications who has also done well in government by bringing these basic business practices to state government, being more thoughtful about our spending, thinking about how we can serve our customers better. We did that in the insurance department. We focused on better customer service. And you know what? Wait times went down. More companies are working in Kansas than ever. Our customers are happier. We're doing a lot of good things for the citizens of Kansas. And many people wonder why we can't bring that same philosophy to the broader state government. It's more than just implementing an ideology. It is about managing what you implement.
Ken Selzer, the Republican gubernatorial candidate in Kansas, is my guest. You also shrunk the size of the insurance department. Tell us what you did there.
We did. We've reduced the number of employees by about 20%. Our costs have sharply dropped. Our productivity, this is the fun part, our productivity has gone way up, way up. The number of calls that come into our department because of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare continue to go up. We receive over 20,000 calls a year now. We had 15,000 calls a year when I first started. And you know what? We're doing that with fewer people because they are focused on serving the people of Kansas.
What can a certified public accountant do to sort of change the culture of state government in Topeka? Mm-hmm. What would you bring to the game?
We understand budgets. I understand budgets. I understand that every day, 24/7, you have to be thinking about costs and spending. A good example, we have from this budget year that we're just finishing to the next budget year, a budgeted 6.8% increase in costs in the state government. And we're doing that on top of a flat economy. Last year in 2017, Kansas was one of only four states that had a negative growth rate.
Some of that spending is due to the Supreme Court ruling on school funding, right?
Sure it is. But you know what? If you're not thinking about how you're going to be more productive and spending more efficiently every day, you can't change that ship, change that attitude overnight. You need a new culture in state government about being more productive. If we get focused on serving the people of Kansas rather than what's going on around us or the next political step we're taking, if we're focused on serving the people of Kansas, we can do it more efficiently. We can innovate just like we did in the insurance department. We had to think about how we were arranging our jobs, how we were serving the people of Kansas. When somebody left to go to the private sector, we always thought about, what part of that job do we actually need? Do we need the whole job? And if it was only part of the job, we parsed out the rest of the job and did away with that position.
But how would you take that kind of attitude and approach, Ken, to the entirety of Kansas state government?
It won't happen if you don't try. We're going to take the same approach we did in the insurance department, and that is thoughtfully, calmly examine every expenditure and making sure that it's needed and that we're getting value out of it. There's a distrust for the accountability, the level of accountability in state government in Kansas. We spend almost $7 billion of taxpayer money and very little accountability in any department. That goes across the board. And when we have people who are managing those departments who know how to manage, know how to demand accountability, it will make a big difference. We need a lot of things, including top-to-bottom auditing instead of just targeted auditing like we do now.
I was going to say, do we need a state auditor like the state of Missouri has?
I don't know that it needs to be elected, but I can tell you every large, complex organization like our government has a internal auditing department that is strong, deep, and looking everywhere to make sure that we're doing things financially according to statute, and that we're operationally efficient. We can bring that same attitude to Kansas government. We don't have that now.
You know, one place you might take a different approach is with CanCare, the health care program for the poor. You've been critical, Ken, about how Jeff Collier, when he was lieutenant governor, oversaw that program. What was your complaint with what he did there?
He didn't manage it. It needs to be managed. All of those things that CMS from the federal government has said about the program were management issues. They were positions that weren't filled, auditing positions that weren't filled, management positions that weren't filled, all of those things that nearly shut down the CanCare program in Kansas in 2016 were management related. That's what I mean. When we implement an ideology, we need to manage it. The MCOs, the managed care part of it, is a good idea. It is saving the state money, but it is so poorly managed that people who are on the receiving end think it's a disaster. It needs to be managed better. We will focus on the management of issues like that. That goes to DCF, that goes to KDADS, the Department of Aging and Disability. It goes throughout our state. It goes into education. It goes into corrections. We need a different attitude in the governor's office.
My guest is Ken Selzer. He's running for the Republican nomination for Kansas governor. You know, we've been through the Governor Brownback tax cuts in recent years. You've come out and said, Ken, that you'd like to cut taxes again. What do you have in mind?
And I wonder if you might be misquoting me a little bit. I've always said we need to lean in on costs so that we don't need more taxes.
Okay.
Part of the issue that we've had over the last number of years or last several years when we've had the tax increases is that we haven't been leaning in on costs. That's different than just doing across-the-board cuts.
So you have to manage the expense side before you cut taxes.
Exactly. You manage the expense side. The disaster that happened with Brownback was that he cut revenues and then didn't come back and cut costs at least half of that. Had that happened, we might have been able to grow into the balance of that tax cut, and there was very little effort to do that. It's easy to call for tax cuts, but unless you're calling for specific expense cuts to go with that, that's rather irresponsible.
How confident are you that Kansas can experience tax cuts again once you've taken that look at the expense side?
I don't know if they can or not, but I can tell you we will be operating more with more productivity and at far more leaner than what we are now, just like we have done in the insurance department. This isn't something that we're speculating about. It's been proven. And you can do that when you have a business background and you understand how to run a business and you understand how important every expense dollar, in this case, every expense dollar is coming from you and I and other taxpayers in the state. We have to treat those expense dollars like they're somebody else's dollars, like they're the taxpayer dollars, not like they're the government's dollars. That is a fundamental difference in thinking.
You know, I'm wondering, the legislature this year considered another tax cut, this one totaling $194 million over 3 years. Lawmakers ultimately backed away from it. Did you support that cut?
I would be supportive of that. Absolutely. That is not a tax cut. That is a windfall to the state coming from the federal code rewrite. That should go back to the people that are paying that. That is a windfall to the state that doesn't belong in the state.
You also favor a constitutional amendment to end the endless litigation over school funding. What do you have in mind there?
I do. There needs to be more definition around the word suitability. There is no doubt. Some other states have that same word suitability that's not defined in their constitution, and their Supreme Courts interpret it differently. Our Supreme Court is interpreting it different, I think, than what the Constitution writers originally envisioned. I think we need more definition around that, about what is suitable or who is responsible for that determination.
Would you favor a constitutional amendment, Ken, that would take the state Supreme Court out of the oversight business in terms of overseeing school spending in the state of Kansas?
I would. I think there's a role for the Supreme Court, but the role for the legislature is to determine how much is spent in different areas of government. It's not the Supreme Court's responsibility to determine how much is to be spent on education.
But what if the legislature falls short of its responsibility that at least today is so clearly spelled out in the Constitution?
Well, that's why we elect legislators. Legislators are elected by their local populations to speak the will of that local population.
But legislatures all the time don't do the right thing. They make mistakes all the time.
Citizens have to vote their legislators out of office if they're not doing what they elected them to do. Same thing for the governor. Same thing for other statewide and regional offices. That it should be up to the local citizenry to elect the people that reflect their values.
How much more money would you be willing to spend now if the state Supreme Court comes out and says the state has fallen short in this last legislative session? Lawmakers voted to spend $525 million more over 5 years. If the judges say that's short, they probably won't spell out a specific number that's needed. How much further would you be willing to go?
I don't think they'll say that it's short. They're practical.
That's a prediction.
I think they will be practical and have it be dealt with prospectively rather than currently and shut down the schools. That's irresponsible on their part. So what if they say they want more going into the future and don't define that much? I tell you, we will find ways to make sure we are more accountable in our education dollars, whatever that amount we decide to do. Let me give you a good example.
But even prospectively, Ken, would you be willing to spend more money on the schools than the $525 that's been allocated if the court says you got to do it?
We're going to adhere to the law. I am law-abiding. We will adhere to the law and work to change the law prospectively. You bet.
What did you think of Governor Sam Brownback's tenure as the state's chief executive? What did you think of that?
I liked him personally. He is fundamentally a good man, and I realize a number of people disagree with that. What he didn't have was a business background. He thought that an $800 million tax cut back in 2012 could be made up with growth, and that's almost impossible. Just about every responsible person thought there would be some expense cuts that would come with that in the year after, and it did not happen. I think if he would have had a business background, he would have saw right through that and understood that issue.
Not long ago, one of your rivals for the GOP nomination, Kris Kobach, was in a parade in Shawnee in western Johnson County, in which he was standing in a Jeep next to a gun mounted in the truck that looked like a 50-caliber machine gun. It turned out to be a replica, but there was enough of an outcry over it that the city issued an apology. What did you make of it?
I am rock solid on the Second Amendment, just like I am rock solid on pro-life. Kris can do what he wants. I can tell you that I am a thoughtful, calm decision maker who can lead. I have proven I can lead in government.
I'm wondering
government.
What you thought of it, Ken, of a candidate for governor riding in a parade with a replica of a 50 caliber machine gun.
I wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think of him doing it?
That's up to him and for the voters in Kansas to decide.
Different topic, President Trump's trade war. How concerned are you about the impact this could have on Kansas farmers out west?
I think it's a big issue. I can tell you rural Kansas supports Trump in general, just truly support him. This trade issue could be devastating. The 25% tariffs that are likely to come on and maybe have already been implemented today by China will be devastating to Kansas. Focused on soybeans, focused on pork, focused on some other agricultural products. That will be devastating. We need a governor who can champion ag. We haven't had that in the 4 months of the current governor. We haven't had that in the last 4 years of the last governor. Kansas is over 40% ag, maybe more when you add on the add-on processing on top of that. If you don't champion ag like some other states around us, we will always be bringing up the rear. Again, remember I said in 2017, we were the fourth worst economy in the United States. And you know what? The other three that were worse than us were all on the East Coast and in southern states. They weren't here in the Midwest. Other economies that depend more on ag than we do are doing better than we are because they have governors who are getting out front championing ag, helping develop new markets, helping open up markets, helping things become more competitive. And it's not happening in Kansas. And I think it's partly because we don't have a governor who is deeply embedded and understands ag and ag business. It's both of those.
Going back to the finances of state government in Topeka, Ken, could you ever support a tax increase during your tenure as governor?
I don't think so. And here's why. And I don't want to be absolute about anything. I'm smart enough to know that. But I will tell you this. There will not be a property tax rate increase coming from the state during my tenure. People don't understand who don't own property that valuation increases already have provided tax increases in total for property taxes. There will not be a property tax rate increase coming out. I don't think we need tax increases because we haven't been focused on better managing our state and the expenditures out of it. If we lean in on costs every day, be thinking about leaning in on costs instead of when we come to the legislative session and suddenly we're short and we have to think about how to make up a deficit, that will always yield a tax increase. We're going to be more strategic and more forward-thinking than that so that we're leaning in on costs and we have a culture and a mentality of leaning in on costs with better customer service.
And yet, the state of Kansas today, a lot of folks look at it and say the Brownback administration borrowed hundreds of millions of dollars from the state highway fund, that schools are underfunded, that state kids in foster care aren't getting the protections they need, that the state prison system is on the brink of unrest and upheaval. And folks look at that and say, clearly, more money has got to be invested in those key areas, and you seem to be taking all that off the table.
We need more investments in different places. And go back with me again to the fact that we were a flat or a negative economy last year. We will get more tax revenues if our economy is growing. That's exactly what President Trump is trying to do for the United States.
You want to wait for that to happen before more investments get made in key areas.
Yeah, we are not going to raise taxes unless there is some incredibly isolated incident that might happen that might force it. But I can tell you, we will always be focused going forward on leaning in on costs and doing things with more thought than we have in the past. And that means just thinking about how we do our job, how to be more innovative in doing our job, how we can be more innovative in arranging our jobs so that we don't need a tax increase. We will not have a property tax rate increase, and I don't think we need any tax increase. I think we ought to be moving towards a marginally lower rate over time, not a higher rate over time. That's the thoughtless way to do it.
Final question for Ken Selzer. The carrying of concealed guns is now allowed on college campuses in Kansas. Should they be?
You know, I tell you, I am rock solid Second Amendment, and I think if somebody has to go to war for our country, I think they ought to be trusted with guns. You know, we need to be thoughtful about all of that. One of the things that distinguishes me from my competitors on the gun issue is I don't think that teachers ought to be given cash incentives to carry guns in schools. I think it ought to be a local school option about whether that even happens.
But if some school districts authorize it, you'd be okay with guns in classrooms in public schools.
I would be, but not with cash incentives. Giving cash incentives to teachers, as both of my opponents have advocated, is asking for disaster. We don't need to do that. We need to be more thoughtful about hardening the perimeters, about making access to schools less easy for perpetrators. We need to be more thoughtful in that direction. We do not need to give cash incentives to teachers.
That's Ken Selzer. He's a candidate for the Republican nomination for Kansas governor. He's the state's insurance commissioner. Ken, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you. Remember, KS for KS on August 7th. Ken Selzer for Kansas.
There you go. Well, we'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics dramatically and talk about great films from 1968. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we examined the proposal to expand pre-K education in Kansas City, Missouri, and got an earful from residents about the sales tax to fund it. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday, meet two more Democratic candidates bidding for Representative Kevin Yoder's seat in Congress. If you think of 1968 as a turbulent year in our culture, it was every bit as turbulent and even revolutionary in the world of filmmaking. It was a year when old Hollywood was rubbing shoulders with the new film school generation, sometimes even in the same room. Suddenly, the old Hollywood ways weren't proving all that winning with filmgoers. The hope for the future lie with the new filmmakers. Today, the cinephiles are back to talk about four films made that year that illustrate all these trends. The cinephiles are Mitch Bryan is a screenwriter and UMKC film professor. It's been too long, Mitch. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Aaron Hammerbeck is a screenwriter who teaches at the Kansas City Art Institute and UMKC. Aaron, welcome to you, too.
Thank you.
And that opening music was from Ice Station Zebra. Mitch, imagine that. 1968 was a turbulent year in American politics, and it turned out to be a turbulent year in film as well.
The times, were a-changing.
Yeah, they were, right?
It's amazing.
What happened that year?
I think there were many elements that came together to kind of make Hollywood have to stop, step back, take a look at what was happening. People weren't going to the movies anymore. Grown-ups weren't. They were staying home. They were watching television. Conversely, young people wanted to get the hell out of the house. Uh-huh. There were 10,000 drive-ins across the country at this point, and so the drive-ins became a place for young filmgoers to see films by young filmmakers. And so often first-run movies would show up at the drive-in. So that was another thing that was happening. And then in Hollywood itself, the infrastructure of the studios was collapsing. Their big studio pictures like Hello, Dolly! Were not making any money at all. And so the studio heads, who were these old guys who've been making movies, guys like Jack Warner in the 30s and 40s, were trying to figure out, what are we going to do? Who can we look to connect with new audiences? And it was the film school generation, people like Lucas and Spielberg and Peter Fonda, Dennis Hopper, and these were the young generation that sort of rushed in to fill this vacuum.
Aaron, in your classes, do you often talk about 1968? Is this a year that sort of rises up and something you have to talk about?
Actually, one of the films that that I'd planned to talk about today, Faces, the John Cassavetes film. I've taught before. It's written and directed by Cassavetes. But yeah, it definitely embodies some more of that rebellion that you see from the independent filmmakers, these young film students that really are rebelling against a lot of what the studio was doing at the time.
Do the films of 68 still hold up? If our listeners go back and pull these things and watch them, are they going to enjoy them?
Some of them, I think, are really, really successful, and they seem to have not aged at all. Some of them, like Ice Station Zebra, that we heard the theme song from at the beginning of the segment, that it seems to not hold up as well. But, films like 2001, I think, are still just as interesting and beautiful as they were in 1968.
Mitch, you went back and looked at some old movie ads and the star from that year, and you were surprised by what you found.
Yeah, it's so spectacular to see all of these movies laid out in front of you. It's not like Netflix where every icon is the same size and everything kind of looks the same. This is ballyhoo. This is get come out, come see this movie. We've got this. And then the variety, Gone with the Wind is in a re-release playing next to 2001. And then next to that, you know, is Rosemary's Baby that just comes out. And then down in the corner, you can see all the listings of all the drive-ins and all the crazy double bills like the Guns of Navarone is showing. And even movies from the previous year, like In the Heat of the Night, are still in release. And so it's a fascinating kind of thing.
You mentioned this term drive-in. What's a drive-in, Mitch?
I know, exactly.
I mean, are they still out there?
We're lucky enough to have, I think, the oldest operating drive-in west of the Mississippi, you know, the Boulevard drive-in.
Down the Boulevard,
yeah,
absolutely.
So that's still there.
But back in 68, they were all over the place.
They were all over the place. And you can remember, even when you were in high school, right? Going to the drive-in and summer nights and these crazy, sometimes they'd have a marathon of four movies and you'd be there all night watching old horror films or something.
We went and watched The Exorcist, a bunch of my high school friends, and we were all scared to death because that film had so much hype about how scary it was. But see, sitting in a car with like 12 people packed in, it somehow made it a little more easier to digest, you know, back in the day. Well, 1968 was also the first year of the rating system, right? Like G for general audiences and R for more mature audiences, and that was a new wrinkle.
Yeah, do you remember what was in between G and R?
No, it wasn't PG, right?
No, it wasn't, and it wasn't even GP. Before GP came M for mature audiences, and nobody knows what that meant. And that's one of the reasons they got rid of it. There were no restrictions. Like with an R rating, you'd have to come with a parent. But yeah, 68 was the installation of this new Motion Picture Association rating system, because prior to that, there had been no rating system. There had been a production code, and everybody had to adhere to it. It was a voluntary code, and the studios were enforcing it. But when the studios lost all of their power, and movies started coming over, especially from Europe, that didn't have to adhere to any kind of rules. So, you know, you'd always go see the sexy European movie that just got here. Everything changed. And so suddenly the studio heads had to come up with some new process where we can rate these movies so people would know what they were seeing.
Aaron, how controversial was that rating code? I mean, what's your recollection?
I mean, you know, it probably very controversial. I mean, up until this moment, there were, you know, there were just these rules that every film had to follow. You know, it's where we get the infamous both feet have to be on the floor if there are people sitting on a bed, and, you know, all this single bed started becoming popular in television.
single beds, that's right.
I think, you know, what's really interesting about, you know, looking at the variety of films at this time is that you have everything from Rosemary's Baby to Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and everything in between. So you have to come up with some way to, you know, make to rate these films, you know, so that people know what's appropriate for which audience, you know.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, if you're just joining us, we're talking about some great films from 1968 and what a pivotal year in filmmaking 1968 turned out to be. Mitch, let's go to some of the films we're going to talk about today, and we'll begin with one we've already mentioned here, which seems to be an enduring film, 2001, A Space Odyssey, about a voyage to Jupiter, human evolution, technology, and existentialism, all packed into one film.
One gigantic spectacle. And in fact, I just got back from Chicago. They've struck a limited number of 70mm prints that are identical to what we would have seen in 68, even with some of the imperfections. Christopher Nolan, the director, oversaw this, and the Music Box Theater up in Chicago was running the 70mm print of 2001. So I went up and saw it, and it was just this extraordinary experience. And it's always an extraordinary experience, especially to see it on a big screen.
I bet.
I teach film studies.
And that's a film you want to see on a big screen, isn't it?
And it's a film that at the Tivoli, where I teach my film studies classes, every fall we always do a Stanley Kubrick unit, and we show that movie on that gigantic screen, and these kids are stunned by it because it is such an extraordinary, immersive experience. That's not to say that you won't get something out of it watching it at home, because the film has constantly stayed on home video. There's a new 4K transfer, Blu-ray that's getting ready to come out. But to really experience it is to see it in that big space. And my suspicion is, when that 4K thing comes out, I bet the Alamo or somebody's going to run it, the same way as the Tivoli will be running Yellow Submarine soon. So these movies, which is also from 68. So every so often these movies come back, you know, and theaters, adventurous theaters, decide to give it a whirl again and, you know, see how people will
in
respond.
In reading about 2001 last night, I was just so struck by what critics said about it, which was, this was a really realistic look at what space travel is really like.
Yeah, and that was his goal. He said to Arthur C. Clarke, I'd like to make a really good science fiction movie because there aren't any, and I want it to be hard science, and I want all of the science in it to make sense. And so things like the iPad, there's an iPad basically in 2001. I mean, he was really looking ahead to what will technology be bringing us. And a lot of the stuff they got right. They didn't get the year 2001 right. We still don't, you know, we don't have a Mars base or a moon base or anything. But he still was trying to create this sense of this hard science. And it's one of the things that endures and makes it so fascinating. But there was no computer technology. And one of the things that's so fascinating is that the film is alive with video screens. Every one of those video screens is hand-drawn animation being projected by a 16-millimeter projector bolted to the backside of the set and synchronized with the cameras. I mean, this is a movie that was so technologically innovative that it wound up costing $12 million, which was like $84 million in adjusted money. So it was incredibly expensive, and he was really on the cutting edge of cinematic research and development, and then shooting it in this 65 millimeter large format. So he was just, Stanley Kubrick was like out there on the edge of the filmmaking universe to make this film.
In terms of plot, where does this film take you beyond the technical aspects you're describing here?
Well, that's the other thing that's revolutionary about the movie, because it's built in these very non-connected chapters. The first one dealing with the dawn of man and the discovery of this thing that's been left probably by aliens that's propels our evolution forward, and they go from not using tools to using tools. And then another segment deals with the discovery of that same obelisk buried on the moon. And so again, this sense that somebody out there is luring us away from our planet, and as soon as we're technologically able to find that, that will move to the next step. And then the last segment deals with the Jupiter mission and the question of artificial intelligence, as arguably the most human character in that segment is the computer, Hal, and Hal goes insane. And so it's very much about this question of, can a human design something perfect when we ourselves are imperfect? And so it's very much also about that. I mean, it's a movie that really attempts to be about everything and does a pretty darn good job of being about everything.
We have a clip here from 2001, A Space Odyssey.
This is the confrontation between Hal and Dave Bowman, who has been locked outside of the spaceship. He went out to try to rescue his fellow astronaut, and Hal is not going to let him back into the ship.
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Where the hell did you get that idea, Hal?
Dave, although you took very thorough precautions in the pod against my hearing you, I could see your lips move.
All right, Hal. I'll go in through the emergency airlock.
Without your space helmet, Dave, you're going to find that rather difficult.
Hal, I won't argue with you anymore. Open the doors.
Dave, this conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
What is it about Hal's voice that has hung with me? I hear that voice again, and it just bugs me, you know?
I don't know. Douglas
you
Rain.
You too, Aaron?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't know. That actor did something pretty magical.
Man, it just stays with you. Okay, our first film, 2001, A Space Odyssey, as we talk about films from the pivotal year of 1968. Aaron, let's turn to a second film here. We've mentioned it, Ice Station Zebra. Listen to this starring cast: Rock Hudson, Patrick McGoohan, Ernest Borgnine, and Jim Brown, the great running back. It's about a nuclear sub that must rush to the North Pole to rescue the staff of the Drift Ice Station Zebra weather station.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting film, and I've really kind of gotten on this submarine movie kick lately. I've been trying to write my own submarine movie, and so been trying to watch Das Boot and
Why a submarine movie? What draws you to that?
You know, I think that it's an environment that absolutely terrifies me, and a really good submarine movie can really flesh that out with the, you know, the claustrophobia, the pressure that's physical and emotional.
Yes.
You know, that there's always the ubiquitous plummet to the sea floor.
Yes.
Something happens. It's the sub is usually sabotaged, like it is in Ice Station Zebra, and you know the propellers stop working, and so they you know, you watch these characters stare in horror as they can see the counter
yes.
going down, and they're
yes.
plummeting to it's it's horrifying to me. And I've read that actual submariners have coffin dreams when they're first out at sea, because they sleep in these tiny beds, and they dream that they're in coffins. And I, you know, for me, it's just it's like Hitchcock dealing with this fear that I have, and so I'm just fascinated by them.
So that brought you to Ice Station Zebra.
Yeah. And Ice Station Zebra, I really love. The first half of the movie is a great submarine movie. Rock Hudson, I think, plays the quintessential submarine captain. Submariners have also described that, you know, when you walk into a room, you know who the captain is. He doesn't have to be in uniform or anything. You just know that is the captain. And for me, Rock Hudson embodies that. And the part was actually supposed to originally go to
Gregory Peck, right?
Gregory Peck, Gregory Peck, who I think would have been wonderful in that role as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something really delightful about the humor that Rock Hudson brings to the role. He's got this sharp and almost acidic wit that is just so great in this part. And it's beautiful. You know, unfortunately, like we were talking about the differences between 2001 and this film is that it was a studio film. And, you know, they were using studio sets with high-key lighting. And you know how in the original John Wayne film True Grit, it's missing the grit because all of the costumes look freshly laundered and pressed, and the buildings all have like a fresh coat of paint on them. This movie, Ice Station Zebra, is missing the ice because the second half of the film happens at Ice Station Zebra, and it's all on a soundstage. And so the you know, the wind machines are blowing, and it just doesn't seem cold. It doesn't seem scary. You know, it's just it loses a lot of that authenticity that a lot of the films of 1968 were doing by actually going to the landscape and filming on location.
What's the clip we have from Ice Station Zebra?
So this happens after that plummet to this, you know, the ocean floor. The submarine has been sabotaged, and you know, Rock Hudson as a Commander Faraday is desperate to find out what happened, and so he's trying to find out from Patrick McGoohan, who plays just the perfect villain, you know, what's going on here.
Haven't you forgotten, Captain? I'm in charge of this operation.
Never entered my mind.
Well, then you'd better take another look at your orders. I haven't labored the point so far, because up to now you've been doing all that's been required of you. But the primary objective of this mission is to get me to Ice Station Zebra. Now, those orders come to you from your chief of naval operations and direct to him from your president. So before we go any further, I suggest that you get me there. Put another torpedo up the spout, blow a hole in the ice, and get me there!
One of my men is dead. Three of them badly hurt, and my ship damn near wiped out. Now you take another look at those orders. I'm in command of this submarine, and I am not sticking another torpedo up that spout or taking another chance or making another damn move until I know exactly what we're doing and why.
Wow.
They both get to slam the table.
Does this film look like it was made in 68 when you watch it from today?
It really does.
It's dated a little bit.
It has aged. And I think that it really does come down to those studio sets, the high key lighting. You know, Rock Hudson has a haircut from 1968. You know, it looks very true to that time. That being said, the performances, as you can tell, Patrick McGoohan, Ernest Borgnine, they are just fantastic in this film. So even though it definitely seems to have dated a bit, I think that it's worth watching just for those performances.
Patrick McGoohan was the Scarecrow and the Scarecrow of Romney Marsh, one of my favorite
all-time
Disney
series. Yeah, good job, Steve.
Kids and I watched it all the time. I love that
series. Yeah, I know. I wish they'd remake that.
I wish
they
would, too.
Swashbuckling Revolutionary War. He was like the Robin Hood of the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, I actually found it I got a DVD of it somewhere. So, okay, another film from 1968, Mitch Bryan, as we survey films from 68, The Night of the Living Dead, about a disparate group of individuals who take refuge in an abandoned house when corpses begin to leave the graveyard in search of fresh human bodies to devour.
So we bounce from 2001, this gigantic budgeted re-exploration of genre with no stars, to this teeny tiny movie made independently by a group of filmmakers in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that also is a re-exploration of genre with no movie stars. Interestingly enough, the main character, played by Dwayne Jones, is African-American, which for the time was really striking. George Romero goes to great lengths to say that he just hired the best actor for the job and wasn't trying to make a political statement, but I don't believe that for a minute. I think the fact that you put this very unlikely kind of hero in place and have him at the center of this collapse of society and have him be the guy who can figure things out and who can step up is particularly interesting given what has happened in society in 1968 with the assassinations and with the turmoil over the war. So this is the other sort of big theme that starts to emerge in so many of these movies, is the old way of America is falling apart and it's time for new power structures, new looks at institutions. There's two people trapped in this house that are not happily married, and they've got a problem with their kid who ends up killing the both of them. I mean, it's like, it's not happy times in America.
Yeah.
And he managed to drill into that with this crazy metaphor of the dead coming back to life, hoping to eat the living, which is still with us. I mean, The Walking Dead is still on TV. Uh-huh. And so this
zombies.
Is one of those, he called them ghouls. Now they're called zombies, but he really set the template for this kind of a film. And it seems perfect that it would happen in 1968.
How successful was Night of the Living Dead?
Well, that's always been an interesting issue, because the movie had strange distribution, and then there were legal things, and there was maybe mob financing behind some of the distribution.
Oh.
And so rights fell away. It fell into the public domain. And I think the figure right now is that it was, made for $114,000, and it has at least grossed $30 million back then.
Oh, my gosh.
So, but it's huge, and I think everybody involved has made some money off of it, but you can still get a print of Night of the Living Dead that belongs to the public domain and can do anything you want with it.
What's the clip we have here?
So this is one of the scenes where the main character sort of asserts his power in this house and pretty much tells everybody who's boss.
We've got to have food down there. We've got a right.
This is your house.
We've got a right.
You going down there with him?
Well,
yes or no? This is your last chance. No beating around the bush.
Listen, I got a kid down there. She can't possibly... I couldn't bring her up here. She can't possibly take all the racket and those things smashing through the windows.
Well, you're her father. If you're stupid enough to go die in that trap, that's your business. However, I am not stupid enough to follow you. It is tough for the kid. That old man is so stupid. Now, you get the hell down in the cellar. You can be the boss down there. I'm boss up here.
Okay. From Night of the Living Dead and Aaron Hammerbeck, I hold the last film, the name of the last film in my hand here. The film is Faces, about a middle-aged man leaving his wife for a younger woman. Shortly after, his ex-wife also begins a relationship with a younger partner. The film follows their struggles to find true love.
Yeah, John Cassavetes' great film, and it took him 3 years to make this. And I'll screen this film with my students at the Kansas City Art Institute, and they have the same kind of reaction as, sometimes you'll see a painting and it'll have just sort of a splash of color on it, and people will say, oh, I could do that. And that's kind of how Faces feels. It took him 3 years to make, but it is so effortless and raw and emotional that it would, I don't know how he made it. To me, it seems impossible to make this film because it's done with, you know, a handheld camera. Most of the film is handheld camera.
And that's an advancement, right? That's something new. Yeah.
And that's definitely, you know, coming from these, you know, these film students, not wanting, you know, the major difference between Ice Station Zebra, you know, it's done with this beautiful film, you know, and these enormous cameras. And this, you know, here we're making sort of a quiet film about the degradation of a marriage with a handheld camera. And it's very uncomfortable because Cassavetes had this love affair with the French New Wave that would have been happening about 10 years prior to this time period. And part of the French New Wave was very interested in self-reflexivity. And so that means that, you know, they wanted audiences to be participants in the film.
I do that. Self-reflexive.
Yes.
Yes, of course.
They wanted to, you know, have audience members be participating in the film and not just passively watching. And so you really truly feel like you are a part of this film.
Let's listen to what's the clip we have here.
So this begins, John Marley's character, who's the husband who's leaving his wife, he comes home after an early evening drink at his friend's house. And his friend has invited a prostitute to come over. And that's played by the incomparable Jenna Rollins, but this is the showdown between him and his wife, played by Lynn Carlin.
No place like home.
What?
I said, have you ever been to Rome?
Italy?
I love you.
But you always love me when I bring food.
Well, that's because I'm a glutton.
Were you with Fred tonight?
Yeah.
I think he's a terrible father. He never talks to the kids or plays with them.
The kids are grown up.
I'm 19 and grown. I don't like Fred anymore.
Well, why don't you like Fred anymore?
Because he cheats on his wife.
Now, who told you that?
Louise.
Oh, Louise. Oh.
Fred talks in his sleep. He comes home at night and he just stares at her. Doesn't say a word. They have a drink. Silence. They eat, they say nothing.
Salt, pepper, please.
They get into bed and they say nothing. And I forgot, he just barely looks at the kids, and Louise says that it's because of that.
Well, that's the film Faces, and that wraps up our survey of good films from 1968. And that one you'd recommend, too?
Oh, yeah. And any Cassavetes film is going to be beautiful, especially if it stars Jenna Rollins.
Okay. I'm going to thank our two good cinephile guests here, Mitch Bryan, screenwriter and UMKC film prof, Aaron Hammerbeck, a screenwriter who teaches at the Kansas City Art Institute, as well as UMKC. Thank you both very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
See you next time.
You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.